This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we could be with you anywhere. But if you're ever in our town, New York City, let us know. We'd love to see you. Our program and this podcast are brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today. This hour, water under threat. The overused Colorado River runs dry, and in California, a ruptured pipeline sends tens of thousands of gallons of oil into the waters off of Santa Barbara. We'll also take you to Washington, D.C., and look at efforts to spur commercial space travel. Or do they just encourage companies not to maximize safety? But first, what happens when a desire for cures leaves people vulnerable? This week, charges have been brought against the operators of four U.S. charities accused of bilking nearly $200 million in donations to fund luxury lifestyles for themselves. Those accused allegedly used private donations to fund lingerie buying trips to Victoria's Secret, visits to Hooters, trips to Disney World, go down the list. Federal investigators say it's one of the largest charity fraud cases ever, involving all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Now, at the center of the operation is James T. Reynolds Sr. He opened the Cancer Fund of America back in 1987 and eventually, with his family members, expanded the enterprise to four separate groups. His network has been under suspicion for a long time, so one of the questions here is, why did it take so long for local and national law enforcement officials to act? Well, the Cancer Fund for America is headquartered in Knoxville, Tennessee. Trey Hargett is Tennessee's Secretary of State, and his advice is to think first before you donate.
What we're all guilty of at times is not holding different organizations that we give money to feet to the fire. These things start somewhere, but you also have to have somebody who calls. You have to have somebody who puts it on the radar screen. It all ramped up a couple of years back when we start collaborating with other states saying, hey, we've all got to join together and do something. And more of a national, a federal approach makes a lot more sense so we can pool our resources. But the real key is we want people to be educated consumers with their charitable dollars. And it also takes a long time, too, because anytime you're investigating a charity, you want to make sure that you're dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. So the last thing you want to do is cast false aspersions. You really want to make sure you get it right whenever you take this kind of action.
Well, at the same time, there seems to be plenty of evidence that law enforcement officials or people who evaluate charities or even consumers themselves should have known more. I mean, Missouri filed suit against the Cancer Fund, one of these charities, way back in 1989. James Reynolds says he's already been sued and settled more than 20 times himself. It's not like he was really flying under the radar at all.
No, it certainly appears that they were not flying underneath the radar. And even now, as you know, the Cancer Fund of America and Cancer Support Services and Mr. Reynolds Sr., they are not part of this settlement that we've reached. So that's still an ongoing matter for the court. So while he says he's been sued and settled before, we've still got this one to go.
So what's going on in Tennessee? I know you speak for the volunteer state. What's going on there to help consumers be more aware if they're not watching enough CNN, I suppose, or reading enough news about how these charities do get sued and do have the scrutiny of regulators and lawyers over the years to prevent them from still sending good money after bad?
You know, unfortunately, one of the things that prior to me getting here, we really thought more of the charitable organizations as the customer. And after I became Secretary of State in 2009, one of the things I told our people is our real customer is that consumer. You know, one of the victims we really haven't talked about and all of this is that there's a finite pie out there of resources that can go for charitable giving. And whenever somebody out there, like these groups that are ne'er-do-wells that are sucking up these dollars, it takes resources away from those that are really trying to do something good for their constituency.
Mr. Secretary, does Tennessee have any particular responsibility here? This is the District of Columbia, the federal authorities, all 50 states, as you mentioned. But this operation was run out of Knoxville in your state. So what's going on at the state level? Is there a crackdown among yourself and your fellow officials there?
Well, we're one of the lead plaintiffs, and we are doing everything we can through the multi-state action. And quite frankly, what it's also done is we've got other phone calls today about other organizations out there where people have said, well, I didn't know that y'all were the place to come to. And so I've got something that I think you should take a look at, you'd be interested in. So our investigators can be very busy, it looks like, for quite some time.
You know, James Reynolds is one of your constituents, running his operation out of Knoxville, as I said. What do you think of him and the other members of his family who were running this operation?
You know, I don't know him personally, and, you know, I don't want to kick somebody when they're down, but I think when you look at the proof, I think the fact that we took action speaks for itself. And Tennessee, in a recent survey, was shown to be the fourth most benevolent state, most generous state in charitable giving in the country. And my goal is to make sure that whatever organizations are operating here, no matter if they're based here or not, that people could have confidence when they give to those charities.
Trey Hargett is Tennessee's Secretary of State, operating out of Knoxville, Tennessee. The Cancer Fund, an umbrella group of four charities, under strict investigation now from the Federal Trade Commission, all 50 states in the District of Columbia, for fraud. Trey Hargett, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
And we're asking you, if you give to charity, how do you decide which ones to trust with your donation dollar? From Texas, I work for a nonprofit, so I'm very careful about who and how I give money. I focus on a wise use of revenue, mission-driven, results-oriented organizations.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to let you know that I contribute only to local charities. It's easy for me to know for sure who's served and in what ways they're being served. There was a sign in my hometown of Tacoma, Oregon, growing up that said, "Think globally, act locally," and that's kind of the mantra I live by when it comes to charities.
Join this conversation, 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. Well, as we've heard, people giving money to cancer charities can certainly be vulnerable if they're not careful. But so can patients, not just cancer patients, but patients with other diseases, ailments that they're desperate to have cured. They might be willing to pay any price, and that's become apparent in the surge of stem cell clinics cropping up across the country. Now, there's a lot of medical hype around stem cells, that's for sure. And these clinics seem to be trading off of that, offering potentially life-saving cures for a bunch of ailments, but with very little oversight and almost no proven results. The price tag, up to $20,000 per procedure. There are no official estimates of the number of clinics, but an investigation by Associated Press health writer Matthew Perrone found that there are now more than 170 clinics nationwide and that the number's growing.
Well, you can find these stem cell procedures for almost any condition or disease you can think of. Everything from hair loss to erectile dysfunction to really serious debilitating diseases like Parkinson's, lupus, multiple sclerosis. It's almost a laundry list of different conditions that they're selling these treatments for.
Okay, so what's the separation here then between the conditions for which stem cells are useful? And the research shows that there are some ailments for which stem cell therapy does work, at least in some patients. And then all of the other diseases and claims that you're talking about, like hair loss and erectile dysfunction and all the others.
Right. Well, what we're really talking about here are adult stem cells. And really, the only mainstream, scientifically proven use for these adult stem cells currently are bone marrow transplants. And those have been used for decades. They save lives. So that's established. That's proven. That's part of mainstream medicine. But really, anything outside of that, especially using stem cells from fat, which is what a lot of these clinics are doing, is still in the experimental stages.
All right, so what are these clinics really doing? If I go in there for a fat stem cell procedure because I have a pesky receding hairline, what's going to happen to me?
So the most common procedure is they're going to liposuction the fat out of your body. They're going to treat it with a drug substance to basically try to separate out the stem cells. And they'll get, you know, maybe a teaspoon, two teaspoons of what they say are concentrated adult stem cells. And they will re-inject that into your body, you know, depending on what they're trying to treat. If it's arthritis, they might inject it into your knee or elbow. But for some of these diseases, you know, more systemic things like multiple sclerosis, they'll just hook it up to an IV bag and infuse it into your bloodstream. And again, the theory there, and this is unproven, but the theory is that somehow these stem cells are going to hone in on parts of the body that are damaged or diseased and go to work on them.
I'm sorry if I'm overly skeptical. I don't think that I am. What you're describing just strikes me as glorified bloodletting.
It's been called quackery. It's been called snake oil. Mainstream researchers at places like Harvard University, UCLA are very disturbed by this. And for years, actually, they've been looking to the federal government, to the Food and Drug Administration, to crack down on these clinics. But the problem is these doctors sort of operate in a gray area. On the one hand, they can argue that what they're doing is in-office surgical procedure. It's the practice of medicine. And in this country, the federal government doesn't tell doctors what they can do in their own offices. But on the other hand, and this is what the critics would argue, when you take cells out of someone, mix them with a drug, create this new mixture, and then re-inject it, you could argue that that is creating a new experimental drug and that, therefore, the FDA should crack down on them. The FDA late last year did come out with a proposal. What the FDA said in this proposed rule was essentially taking fat out of people, processing it, re-injecting it. That's actually creating an experimental drug. And therefore, you can't sell that in the U.S. without it being approved and reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration. The catch is that, you know, the FDA is a very large, sometimes slow-moving bureaucracy. And so this proposed rule, in order for it to become binding, it has to be finalized. And that's a process that can take years. And sometimes these proposals are never even finalized.
Well, you spoke to Dr. Mark Berman. He's one of the leading physicians who's peddling this form of, I'll call it medicine for the sake of this interview, and he's in Beverly Hills. He has lots of customers. So let's listen to Dr. Berman.
You have to realize everything that we're giving the patient back is already in their body. Are we helping people or hurting people? And the truth is, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, we're really just helping people.
We're really just helping people, he says. Now, a lot of the people who go in to see Dr. Berman may have hair loss, or they want cosmetic injections in their face, or maybe erectile dysfunction is their problem. One might argue that if you want to try something unconventional and it's not life or death, hey, it's your money.
That's true. Berman, he talks about what he does as patient-funded research. So he typically charges about $9,000 for one of these procedures. And he says, he hasn't published any studies yet, but he says he is working on studies that will show that this is safe and effective. But as you suggest, the problem there is, you know, there's a lot of medical research going on in this country all the time. But what you don't see is patients paying thousands of dollars to essentially be part of an experiment. And so when you talk to the large networks, the big companies selling these treatments, they'll tell you they've never had any serious complications. They have never had any real injuries. And from what we can tell, that seems to be true. When you dig down a little deeper into some of the smaller practices, individual physicians, unfortunately, you can find instances where stem cell procedures seem to have gone terribly wrong. Earlier this year, there was a cardiologist, a doctor in Florida, Dr. Zanos Grekos, had his medical license revoked. This was after two patients under his care died after undergoing stem cell procedures. In the first case, a 77-year-old man suffered cardiac arrest after he had stem cells infused into his bloodstream. There was a second patient, a 69-year-old woman, who had stem cells infused into the arteries of her brain. She suffered a stroke. So, you know, there may be safer, less safe ways to infuse these cells. But, you know, again, I think most doctors would tell you anytime you're manipulating cells outside the body, then putting them back into the bloodstream, the risks are serious.
Matthew Perrone, health writer for the Associated Press. Thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. The first batch of thousands of emails that Hillary Clinton sent through a private email address while serving as Secretary of State have been obtained by our partner, The New York Times, well ahead of the State Department's scheduled first release date of January 2016. Now, both the media and Clinton have requested the messages be made public, and so far, they appear to contain sensitive but not classified information, largely from around the time of the attacks in Benghazi. And of course, those attacks and their aftermath are the subject of an intense investigation in Congress by an ongoing special committee. For more now, we go to Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Good to have you. Well, what do these emails show about what was known about the attacks on the compound by Hillary Clinton in Benghazi around that time and in its immediate aftermath? Are we learning anything new?
What we're learning is that Hillary Clinton was receiving sort of intelligence-like cable was from a longtime confidant named Sidney Blumenthal, who had been prevented from joining her at the State Department. And he was providing her with his account of what occurred in the attacks, and she was circulating his accounts to others in the State Department. The interesting thing is that some of his accounts actually contradicted what the administration said really happened at the time.
In what ways do they contradict what the White House was saying, the Obama White House?
Well, the White House came out and said that it was not a pre-planned attack and it was a spontaneous outgrowth of this protest, but Mr. Blumenthal sent Mrs. Clinton a very detailed memo 2 days after the attacks that said indeed it had been a terrorist attack planned by this group from Eastern Libya, and she circulated that to her inside the State Department and said, get this around ASAP.
Now, the role of Sidney Blumenthal is a newish development as well. He has been subpoenaed by the special committee investigating Benghazi on Capitol Hill. He'll testify eventually. His relationship with the Clintons is a long one. People may remember him from back in the first Clinton, the only Clinton administration we've had, the administration of President Bill Clinton, his role in the aftermath of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, longtime confidant and lawyer. But what was his role here? Why was Sidney Blumenthal sending memo after memo on national security matters, sensitive ones, from outside the administration to the Secretary of State?
We don't really know. People in power apparently get a lot of emails from different folks and friends giving them different tips about things. The Clinton campaign has said that she did not request any of this information. It was all unsolicited. But what was happening is that she received 25 of these memos from Mr. Blumenthal over a 2-year period of time. And they were very detailed and they were addressed directly to her. And he was providing her with information from intelligence sources that he had on the ground in Libya. So it wasn't simply just, oh, here, I heard this at a cocktail party, let me pass it around. It was a systematic sending of memos.
Is it surprising to people in the national security spheres that Sidney Blumenthal is apparently sourced inside the government in Libya, that he can update the Secretary of State in this way?
I think a lot of people that know Mr. Blumenthal from the first from the Clinton White House back in the 90s are a bit surprised by this and didn't think of Mr. Blumenthal as someone that had a particular amount of expertise in Libya or foreign affairs.
And there is some skepticism to some of the accounts you can see from Secretary Clinton herself, where she says this sounds like a conspiracy theory or this one sounds thin, but not to all of them, only to a couple.
Correct. She had sort of a wide range of responses to them. Some of them she thought were dubious, and some of them she wanted to get into the hands of Chris Stevens, the United States ambassador in Libya, and into the hands of other senior State Department officials to get their reactions to it. She wanted some of them, as I said, circulated immediately. She wanted some of Mr. Blumenthal's advice passed to the White House. And she wanted a lot of the memos that he sent printed, and apparently that was because she could read them. She preferred to read things in a printed form.
We should remind people, Michael Schmidt, if they're not thinking about it already, that the emails that you're reporting on, indeed the ones that will be released by the State Department and are in the possession now of the Special Committee investigating Benghazi, are ones that she has essentially selected. She handed over many of the emails that were on her private server. The ones she deemed not worthy of public attention are gone.
Correct. Well, what happened was that the state last year, she handed over 55,000 pages of emails to the State Department, and that was in response to a request from the State Department for all records that she had that may not be in the State Department's possession. She then said in after it came out that she had exclusively used a personal email account, that she deleted about another essentially 30,000 emails that were on the account that she didn't pertain to her time as Secretary of State.
So a selection of the emails are now becoming public emails that the State Department will eventually release. And there is an ongoing investigation still on Capitol Hill around Benghazi and the emails of former Secretary of State and presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton. Michael Schmidt, for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
We go to Washington now, where the Spurring Private Aerospace Competitiveness and Entrepreneurship Act of 2015, otherwise known as the SPACE Act, is on the floor of the House today. Texas Republican Congressman Lamar Smith co-authored the bill. Its fate is unclear. There are disagreements with the Senate, but one controversial part of the bill would immunize private space companies from liability for crashes or accidents. And that's what Linda Lipson, CEO of the American Association for Justice, takes issue with. She says the current House bill is an improvement over an older version, but she says that protecting tomorrow's space companies from passenger and victim lawsuits isn't worth the competitive advantage.
The best way for these companies to be competitive is to produce the safest products possible and to provide a safe place for passengers to travel. So the first thing that these companies are doing is going to Congress and asking for immunity. And the reality is if no one is accountable, no one is really safe. So, you know, we're asking the industry to take a look at themselves. And instead of hiring a bunch of lobbyists and PR firms to create this crisis, this immunity crisis, instead what they should be doing is putting the value into space travel and making sure that it's safe for the flying public.
The counter argument, of course, and the space industry is not the first one to have this argument, is that if you're spending a bunch of money on insurance and on lawsuits, you're not pouring that into R&D, you're not pouring that into development, and you're not pouring it into investment. And that's what everybody wants. So what's wrong with that argument?
Well, you know, the price of insurance is the price of doing business. What companies need to do is to put their investments into safety. And that is what, you know, the public wants. In fact, when these travel options become available, what the public is going to be looking at primarily is safety. And the first thing that they're going to hear is that the industry went to Congress trying to get immunity. I don't think that's a very good message. Remember, individuals need remedies when they're injured by dangerous products. They do not need the government to shield companies from their own recklessness. This language that is in the bill presently would allow this commercial space industry to actually be shielded from reckless, wanton, negligent conduct, and that's just completely inappropriate and sends the wrong message to the traveling public.
The companies and their lobbyists, of course, will turn it right around on you at the American Association of Justice and say, you guys used to be called the Trial Lawyers Association, and all you want is the right to continue to sue so that you can do your business line, which is lawsuits.
Well, you know, individuals deserve their day in court. They deserve a remedy when they're harmed by a dangerous product. And the best route to avoiding that is to make the product safe in the first place. And it's something we all can agree on. Let's roll up our sleeves and get that part done. The amount of resources spent in Congress by industry after industry, from gas can manufacturers to drug manufacturers to the oil industry, all of it, the amount of money and resources that have gone into political action committees designed to make it impossible in many cases for individuals who, through no fault of their own, are injured because of the products that these companies produce is staggering, unfortunate, and really the values need to be turned around.
You said that the House bill had improved somewhat in terms of the breadth and scope of the immunity that was being debated there. How has it improved? Why is it different?
Well, the original immunity provision would have established immunity for commercial aircraft from injuries that occurred not just in the vehicle itself, but also in the ground. So let's say you had a commercial space vehicle that collided into a field, killing a family. That family would now, under the present iteration of the House bill, have a right to pursue their remedies in court. The area that is not covered in the House bill has to do with individual passengers. And you know, individual passengers have a right to be safe when they purchase a ticket. And so I just think that particularly an industry that is at the inception of their development, they do not need to be sending a message to our the flying public or potential consumers that they're not going to put a high value on safety, that instead they're going to go to Congress and ask for immunity.
Passengers can sue airlines right now if there's a plane crash. Is that right?
Exactly. And so can bystanders on the ground.
So why would a spacecraft be any different, I guess, than a winged airplane?
Exactly. A very good point, and that's exactly the point that we're going to be making. Absolutely.
All right. Linda Lipson, CEO of the American Association for Justice, thank you.
Thank you very much.
One note, we invited Congressman Smith to join the conversation on our program today. He was unavailable.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Take a second now. Listen to these sounds. See if you recognize them. All right, that's not the takeaway carpentry shop. No, all of those were pencil sharpeners. So when was the last time you heard any of those sounds? And for that matter, when was the last time you even used a pencil? It used to be the most important tool of any artist, right? The staple of creation, I guess you'd call it. Now, passé, or even an endangered species, at least in the mainstream it is. Sure, sketch artists still sketch, and animators still draw, and pencils will always have their place for things that absolutely need to get down on paper, not in pixels. But even animators and designers can easily draw with computers and tablets, and they don't even need to get up and stop working to sharpen anything. One listener, Cynthia, told us on Facebook, pencils are like socks. They will always just get lost. But don't despair if you're devoted to the graphite and the wood. The pencil still has its champions. A new photography exhibit in London is celebrating the pencil as an artistic emblem, one that shows the inner character of the artist who uses it. Photographer Mike Tinney captured pencils that belong to famous artists. One belongs to the actor Stephen Fry, another to novelist Dave Eggers, Oscar-winning makeup artist Michelle Burke, her pencil's in the exhibit, along with many others. The photos will be auctioned off, and the proceeds will go to charity. Joining me now is Alex Hammond. He's creative director of the exhibit. Alex Hammond, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. What is so great about pencils?
Well, we feel it's still really relevant in this digital age, and this is the reason for the project. We realize that many of these really class A creatives still use the pencil, even when they had creative digital tech surrounding them. And the reason for this was that it still had this immediacy and ultimate accessibility, which really gave it the power to communicate ideas almost instantly. So the eureka moment might be the spark of inspiration. So it's about what tool is the quickest at achieving that communication of an idea. And it's kind of that process that we found that is still used by so many of these amazing creatives, whether you're makeup like Michelle, or whether you're an architect, whether you're an author, an illustrator, a screenplay writer, they still have pencils at the core of their creative process.
All right, well, it's the pencil that helps do the creating, but your exhibit is made up of photographs of the pencils themselves, what they look like when the creating is all done, like the physical effects on the pencil. What can you tell about the attitude or the work of a creative person based on the pencil that they leave behind?
So the photos that we've taken, they're incredibly detailed. They're not just a photo of a pencil. The pictures are 30 or 40 inches tall. So when you get to that level of detail, you start to see beyond what the human eye can normally see. So the way they sharpen it, whether they have it next to a blue pencil in their box, whether they chew their pencil, what brand it is, all these sorts of things become really important. And we think that's an insight into their creative process. So the really good example is a chewed pencil. Now, is that someone who's nervous, or is that creative energy that they're trying to expel by sketching, by drawing, by writing? So the pictures do themselves reveal something about the artist?
Well, one of the pencils in your exhibit belongs to William Boyd. He wrote the new James Bond movie, big-time screenwriter. What can you tell about him and his creative process? What makes him tick by looking at a close-up of his pencil?
Good choice of pencil, really. Good choice of person. William Boyd's pencil is a mechanical pencil, and he's had it for 15 years. And so all the novels that he's written in the last 15 years have been through this pencil. So you can see the wear and tear, the metal finish is coming off, and it's really showing signs of age. But because it's a mechanical pencil, obviously you can replace the leads. And when he gave it to us, it had a blue lead in it. That means something. Maybe he just fancied a change. But it's really, you can see the blood, sweat and tears which have gone into those novels represented by this aging pencil.
Sorry, I can't help it, but the writer of a James Bond screenplay with a mechanical pencil, I want Q to be showing it to him because it has a poison tip.
Obviously it does. And it's also bright pink, which was a bit of a surprise to us.
You've also got the actor and comedian Stephen Fry. He'll be known to a lot of American audiences for sure.
Yeah, interesting one, because he's so known for his love of digital. He's huge on Twitter. And so when we approached him, he said, well, I do use digital, but there's still pencils in our studio. And so when you have that immediacy of taking down a note or externalizing an idea, he reaches for the pencil. And this particular pencil that he donated to us was actually gifted to him by a super fan. And it says Stephen Rules OK on it.
Let's play a little bit of a game, Alex, shall we? I would like to maybe go down a list with you of some hypothetical pencil users, since you're the expert, and maybe decide what their pencils might look like. You game?
Yeah, definitely. Go for it.
All right. How about Steve Jobs? What about his pencil?
Good one. So there's a lovely pencil made by the brand Moleskine that's very sleek. It's kind of rectangular in cross-section. It's a lovely matte black. So maybe something like that.
All right. Well, Hillary Clinton is now famous, or infamous if you want, for not liking to share a lot of her writings, wanting them to stay secret. She's also going to have a very chaotic and busy year over the next year. What do you think about Hillary Clinton's pencil when she's not texting?
I think she would have both ends of the spectrum. So maybe she'll have a beautifully bejeweled, wonderfully crafted pencil holder, and then the actual pencil that goes in it would be a very run-of-the-mill kind of standard everyman's pencil to keep it politically neutral.
Oh, so you're saying Hillary Clinton would have every aspect of the pencil to cover all of her bases, sort of the everyman's pencil?
I think the everyman, but still having some little bit of bling in there just to flash it up a bit.
All pencils to all people, that makes sense. All right, how about Taylor Swift?
I think it would be a very well-sharpened, perfectly sharpened, manicured pencil.
Designed to sell?
Yeah, it may be bright red.
All right, but Alex, I mentioned earlier that the proceeds for your exhibit are going to charity.
Absolutely. So the charity, which is called Children in Crisis, they are the benefactors of the exhibition and the auction. So there's a lovely cyclic process here. We are celebrating creatives at the top of their game from all these different fields, and we're auctioning off a print with their actual physical pencil mounted in a frame. Now, the proceeds go back into Children in Crisis, and then they in turn support their projects in Sierra Leone and Burundi and the DRC Congo, where they are enabling the education and the development of some of the children affected by the conflicts in those territories.
Well, the iPhones are away, the laptops are shut, where The Secret Life of the Pencil, which runs in London from May 20th through June 3rd. Alex Hammond is the creative director. Alex, thank you.
Thanks very much.
You can see lots of photos of the pencil exhibit on our website at thetakeaway.org. And we've got one more call from a listener who can't help but share some pencil memories.
Hi, Todd. It's Mom. I recognize those pencil sharpening sounds at the top of your piece. Hearing those sounds brought back lots of childhood memories. When I was a kid, we had a school model hand crank sharpener mounted on a wooden joist in the basement. Your Nana, though, would sharpen all her foam doodling pencils with a knife at the kitchen sink. And that produced those beautiful flat sculptured planes at the tip. Oh, I can smell the shaved wood now.
Oh, geez, Mom. Thanks. Yeah, Nana used to doodle on her pad on the phone for hours and hours. Well, that's all for today. You can always weigh in, just like Mom did, at 8778MyTake. Send us a tweet, which Mom won't, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.